Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Former Maine Senator Olympia Snowe has some thoughts on political dysfunction. She doesn't like it any more than most of us. We'll talk with her about that in a couple of moments. But first, they say the talk is cheap. That has a double meaning when it comes to equal pay and opportunity for women, especially minority women, blacks and Hispanics. While women in the workforce earn only about three-quarters of what their male counterparts make, Latinas and blacks earn even less. A symposium on the persistent problem women face with unequal pay for equal work will take place on Friday at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Joining me to talk about the inequity and why it persists are attorney Donna Harper of the Sade Harper Law Firm. It specializes in workplace discrimination issues. Lydia Padilla is owner-operator of TRC Staffing, a job placement service. Dr. and Professor Sally Ebest directs the Gender Studies Program at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. I'd like to thank you all for being with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sally, let me begin with you. Can you kind of broad stroke this problem for us? We've talked about it before, but particularly with regard to minority women.
I think the biggest problem with pay equity is gender socialization. Whether you are a minority woman or not, but I would say more so in that case, young women are simply not socialized to negotiate. So, for example, if you think about young men when they played sports, they are constantly negotiating. I was out, no you weren't, or he was out, no you weren't, etc. Women might play sports, but there's not nearly as much negotiation going on. And for a lot of men, it's almost a second nature to do that. Whereas young women I've talked to these recently who are strong feminists who've been all over the world, who work, one in particular works for women's rights for the UN, never occurred to her to negotiate for her salary. So it's just something that we don't talk about. So it's nice that we have this forum.
But are you suggesting that Caucasian women are better negotiators than
blacks
and Latinas?
No, I'm not at all. I'm saying women in general. Probably the only exception might be women in the College of Business. And they tend to get exposed to some of it, but not really that much.
Don Harper, how do you see it?
I think my clients suffer from the same phenomena. They don't aggressively pursue pay increases, partly because they fear some kind of backlash at work, and partly because they think that they're being treated fairly. They hope they're being treated fairly, and often they don't know how they're being treated with respect to pay decisions. So I think women don't negotiate. I don't think they even ask forcefully most of the time for pay increases. They just look to see whether they are making what they hope is at least a cost of living increase. If they're promoted, they hope they're making getting an increase that's substantial enough in their own minds to be a sign that the company has recognized this promotion as, worth more to them and worth more to the company as well.
And Lydia Padilla, you see this from another perspective, I think. How do you see it from the staffing agency perspective?
For me, my candidates sit in a position that when I interview them, they have an expectation of what the salary should be, and a client might have a different idea of what the salary should be. So if a company is looking to pay a candidate $50,000 and the job market requires $65,000 to do the position, then I have to counsel the employer about appropriate pay for the perfect candidate they're looking for. So in some respects, I get to negotiate on behalf of the candidate, whether it's a male or female or minority or not, and counsel the companies on best practices to retain, attain, and maintain the best candidate pool that's in the market.
What do you run into in terms of resistance, if any, with regard to the pay issues when you're doing the negotiating?
I think there's a misconception about the unemployed workforce that's available right now, that it's excessive, that everyone's looking for a job, and qualified candidates for example, candidates with a master's degree, unemployment's only about 2%. A PhD, it's about 1%. And this is data from the Workforce Investment Board in Slate. If you don't have a high school diploma, it might be about 27 or 28% unemployment. So employers tend to think that there's this mass influx of qualified candidates in the market waiting for a job and waiting for them, and they can be flexible in the salary, or they could be aggressive in lowering the salaries or their overhead costs for labor, but that's not truly the case. Qualified standout candidates are really hard to find, and it's competitive to get them right now.
Sally Ebest, your thoughts about that?
Well, as both Donna and Lydia were speaking, I was rethinking my response to your first question. And I think part of the reason that you see Latina and African-American women, or any minority women except for Asian Americans or Asians, paid less is because proportionately there are fewer of them who have advanced degrees. If they have the advanced degrees, I think they're more likely to be paid better, but they still might not negotiate, because if you're not accustomed to a certain social class, once you get that degree, you're just so happy to get a job.
And Donna, you looked at some figures. We talked about this prior to going on the air. Missouri does not stack up very well in this whole equation, does it?
Well, in terms of just census data, I just looked at where women's median earnings are when they're employed full time. Women's median earnings in Missouri were $32,000 a year. We ranked 38th out of all the states. Men's median earnings in Missouri were $43,000. We ranked 34th, so men were doing better. And the earnings ratio between men and women employed full-time was 74.4%, just as you said at the outset, about three-fourths of what men make. Women make about three-fourths of what men make when they're both employed full-time, at least in Missouri.
Well, you know, we've been having this conversation, not the four of us directly, but I think as a society, having this discussion for a long time. We had the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which was President Obama's first act as president, signing that act. We've got other equal pay legislation that's been out there for a long time. Why is this moving so slowly? Does anyone have an idea, aside from the inability, unwillingness to negotiate?
I will tell you why I see it moving slowly.
Yeah.
Pay secrecy is a huge problem. You know, in the federal government, employees know that the person who sits next to me is a GS-9 or a GS-13 or a GS-4. In the state government, salaries are public. I think they used to be printed every year in a blue book, but they're available. In a lot of organizations, what your coworkers make for doing the same or similar kinds of work is readily available or ascertainable. That is not true in the public sector. So, for instance, you'll have a woman who has been getting fabulous performance evaluations and raises, who then may learn years later that despite those great evaluations, despite that recognition, she's being paid less than men.
Lilly Ledbetter is a case in point.
Yeah, Lilly Ledbetter, I think some of the evidence was that her evaluations weren't necessarily fabulous, but the awards given to her for her performance were fabulous. So you had, you know, directly conflicting evidence about what her performance was. In other words, they recognized her great performance, but when it came time to give her the paper that would justify the raise, they rated her down.
Lydia, you buy into that? The fact that salaries are secret is a big part of the problem?
Absolutely. It's always been, and no matter what level in my career that I've been at, no one wants to talk about salary. The thing we do talk about in my industry is commissions. So those are usually a pretty public part of employment knowledge across the entire group of employees, because if you do $1 million in sales, you know you get 5% of it. That's pretty standard. But when it comes to the base salary, I was in corporate America for 10 years before I started my own recruiting company, and we didn't even talk about it, and we were an industry that talked about salary.
Sally, is this something, if we just change that process and that procedure, that the problem of inequity goes away?
I don't think so. When JFK was in office, that's when the first Equal Pay Act was passed, and since then, the problem has been that it's simply not enforced. There are rules, but they're not enforced across the board.
I would. I'd like to add to that. I mean, the Equal Pay Act was passed in 1963. It sprang from an executive order that was issued during World War II. So women coming into the workforce because men were off to war, you know, they were at least for government contractors. The government said you got to pay them fairly. You got to pay them what you were paying men. When the men came back, the women were displaced. Eventually, you got the Equal Pay Act. The Equal Pay Act is not an act that is effective for a broad range of pay decisions because it relies on a comparison of two, if not identical, substantially similar jobs where the skill, effort, responsibility are the same or substantially similar working conditions in the same establishment. It's a big, complicated test that you have to meet. A lot of pay disparities now for women are not pay disparities that are based on engineer one and you're an engineer one and we both do the same kind of work. The pay disparities now are in jobs that have a bigger range of duties. And what happens is when a woman gets into the job, the value of the work being done sometimes is lowered. The perception is you can get a woman for less. We're going to pay her less. And as more and more women get into that line of work, it becomes no longer as highly paid. And I would say, in my experience, human resources is an area that used to be, you know, it used to be huge and male. I remember starting in the government in the early 70s and dealing with human resources executive vice presidents, and they were all men. I never saw a woman. And I don't think that's true anymore. I think many, many human resource professionals are women. And although I've never studied this, I suspect they aren't paid at the same level, accounting for inflation, as the men were paid back in the 70s and early 80s.
I want to pick up on that point. I have to take a break. We'll do that now. We are talking about the pay inequity issue among women in general, but more specifically amongst minority women, Latinas and African Americans. My guests in studio are Donna Harper, from whom you've just heard, from the Sade Harper Law Firm. Lydia Padilla is owner and operator of TRC Staffing, and Dr. Sally Best is director of gender studies programs at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Back to continue this conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation on the pay inequity issue involving women, particularly minority women, in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Missouri Attorney General Chris Koster is one of the central characters in a New York Times investigation about the influence of lobbyists on state's attorneys general. The newspaper story says Koster put a stop to his office's investigation of the makers of the popular 5-hour energy drink after lobbyists made campaign donations to him. Koster dropped Missouri's involvement in the investigation after meeting with the company's attorney at a conference at Four Star Beachfront Hotel in Santa Monica, California. St. Louis Public Radio has reached out to Koster for comment, but we have not yet heard back. The St. Louis Zoo Museum District Board is meeting at this hour to nail down a stricter ethics policy. If approved, it would end months of haggling over recent conflict of interest allegations. And the removal of more than 1,000 trees on the grounds of the Gateway Arch is underway today. The National Park Service says about 800 of those trees are expected to die due to an invasive beetle called the emerald ash borer, which destroys ash trees. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Dr. Sally Ebest, Lydia Padilla, and Donna Harper as we discuss the pay inequity issue amongst women. Let me come back to the point that you were making, Donna, a moment ago about HR people and the role that they play in this. In fact, you think most of them are women. But I think it's probably fair to say that in the workplace itself, most of the bosses are probably men and most of the people making those decisions. Does that have any bearing on the fact that they're willing to pay women less? Lydia?
It's proof is in the numbers. It's a happening. So yes, that's willing to happen because it is happening. Yeah. And I don't think the pay disparity has increased much in the last 30 years. I think it's maybe gone up 2 cents. I don't know the exact data, but it is happening and it's a reality and the numbers show it. There are look at women participation on public boards, look at women participation in elected offices across mm-hmm. the country and across the states, there's much less women participation at all of those decision-making levels.
That, did you want to say something, Sally? You know, we note that there are more women graduating from college right. these days than there are men. And I wonder if you think that is likely to impact this down the road at some point. Sally?
Lots of studies have shown that that is going to be the case and that women are becoming the primary breadwinners. Whether they're still being paid fairly is a whole different issue. Hmm. But as I think as more women earn more degrees, ideally they will earn more money, but I don't know. It depends on who their boss is.
Donna, you're rolling your eyes.
Well, I just want to say a little bit more about this whole issue of pay secrecy. I mean, there have been some moves by the federal government, both in the National Labor Relations Board, in its own decisions, and in court cases in which people have been fired for talking about pay. Mm-hmm. And they made a complaint to the National Labor Relations Board, and the National Labor Relations Board took the issue to courts or made the decision on its own. And what we're seeing now is that the NLRB has said that when people talk about pay, that's concerted activity that's covered by the law. And it's not lawful under many, many circumstances. It's not lawful to penalize an employee by firing them for disclosing pay, and in fact, they've actually ruled that there are some policies that have been written by companies requiring people to keep things, personnel matters, confidential. People get fired because of it, and the NLRB says you can't do that. So that's a little bit of sort of light in the darkness here, letting people talk about pay and finding out what others are making, and maybe that will allow people to negotiate a little bit more.
But I would think that that's something that most of us would want to keep private. Wouldn't you think?
I don't believe so. I think
That's Lydia.
This is Lydia. I was a corporate employee for 10 years, and I left because I was in a position where I wanted to be a partner, and they weren't willing to make me a partner or pay me what I felt was adequate for the work and the revenue that I was producing for the company. That's why I left, opened up my own business, and said I'm going to be in charge of my own destiny. So it was an opportunity and scary and a risk. I was a vice president leaving a well-paid position, but underpaid. Well-paid, but underpaid. And some women and a lot of minorities don't have the opportunity to walk away. And so they get trapped into a position that does pay well, and it is a great position, but they have, families or children, and there's a lot of responsibility, and there might be some flexibility in the job that employers offer in lieu of pay that isn't necessarily a fair way to compensate, because the flexibility is usually there already for the men in the similar positions.
You are obviously one of those who is not afraid to negotiate. Correct. But look what it got you. You did negotiate and you felt you had to leave the company.
Absolutely. My mother didn't have a lot of options or opportunities. Yeah. She was a Hispanic teenage mom with three kids. And if they said this packaging job pays $6, then it paid $6. And that's what she did. She didn't have a lot of options. So I think that was a great learning experience for me to say that's not acceptable and that's not okay. But you have to leave yourself options. And a lot of times, women in general and minority women don't have lots of options to take those risks.
Donna Harper, your firm just went through a case like this with the Francine Katz case, alleging discrimination by Anheuser-Busch in her situation. This was a more dramatic case, I think, than most because it involved a whole lot of money. What recourse does the average woman have if she feels that she is being discriminated against in this sense?
Well, I mean, she can talk to a lawyer before she talks to anybody else to see if she has enough information and the right kind of information to have options. Okay? Then she needs to know what those options are. She can, of course, always go to her own HR department. Sometimes that results in her getting targeted for for retaliation, sometimes not. But she needs to, in my view, needs to talk to a lawyer first before she risks her career and her reputation by going to HR. And then a lawyer who knows this area of the law can tell her, okay, you've got enough information, but here's the risk you take. What do you want to do? What are your goals? Do you want to get out first, then come back? There are lots and lots of things that need to be discussed before she surfaces her head in that trench and gets it shot off.
But she has two strikes against her going in, because the information that she has to have her make her case is information that's not readily available to her.
That's usually the case, but sometimes people find out what others are making. Sometimes they know enough and they can come to see a lawyer. And sometimes the lawyer has experience with that particular company too, and can say, can guide the employee and say, if you surface this complaint, here are the likely outcomes. If you don't surface it, you know, here's what you're up against. It just depends on what she wants to do, how much risk she can take, what her goals are, and that's all individual.
Any thoughts on that, Sally?
It takes practice. What I have learned, we offer on the University of Missouri St. Louis campus workshops for women to learn how to negotiate. And the most important part, and so this is for women returning to the workplace as well as young women entering for the first time, but they have to practice. That's a key part of the workshop because, again, going back to lack of socialization, they're not accustomed to doing this. So they have to practice. They also have to do their homework. And so there are some websites where you can look up what you should be earning based on where you live. And so you can come up with the information, not as much maybe as comparative within a company, but to show what you should be earning. But it's still not easy.
Lydia, have you run across this part of it?
Not necessarily, because I'm given very targeted job descriptions with standard pay structures in place, and pay and salary is on the table before we ever start having conversations mm-hmm. with candidates. Right.
Donna, how tough are these cases to make? I mean, obviously, it's tough to get the information you need to pursue it. But once you go to trial or arbitration or whatever the situation might be, how difficult is it then?
Well, every case is fact specific, so I don't want to generalize. I think when we decide that we will represent a person who has a complaint that she's being paid less because of her sex or because of her race or her race and sex or her national origin and sex, mm-hmm. whatever the case may be, when we decide to do that, we know that there are a lot of procedural hoops to jump through. We know that there are a lot of risks to our client along the way. And what we hope to achieve is what our client's goal is. And usually the goal is to get the pay recognition that has been denied. I will tell you that most cases in this area, in an employment arena, most cases do resolve. They don't resolve for everything the employee wants or thinks she is entitled to. And they certainly don't resolve for zero, which is with a starting point with the employer. So most cases resolve.
If a woman feels that she has been terminated or reassigned because she has complained or brought this issue up, what recourse does she have then?
Retaliation, you mean? If she's been retaliated against?
Yeah, I guess that's the best way to put it.
Well, if she's been retaliated against because she made a complaint.
Feels she's been retaliated against, that's tough to prove, isn't it?
No, that's not tough to prove usually. I mean, retaliation actually is one of the more sort of concrete.
Really?
Yeah, because typically what happens is a woman says, she goes to HR and says, I'm making $38,000 a year and 5% commission. I understand you just hired in a man and are paying him to do the exact same work. You're paying him $42,000 a year and 5% commission. She'll get to have a conversation going. And then if thereafter things change for her, her territory gets cut, her accounts get reassigned, her pay gets lowered, she gets written up for things that she was, able mm-hmm. to do before, it's pretty clear that there's some kind of reaction to her complaint. Yeah. So those kinds of things are less difficult to prove than you might imagine.
Although she could be told, you just haven't been doing the job as well as we expected.
Certainly, that is said.
Yeah, we've only got a minute and a half left. I want to go around the table and start with you, Lydia. Best advice for people, women who are listening, who feel that this is happening to them.
I think they need to be able to stand up and be brave and make a move if they think it's not fair. And if their work is professional, if they leave on good terms, I think they'll find other career opportunities that they don't know might be out there for them.
Sally?
Women need to value what they know and be willing to fight for a better salary, and also to realize that it's not just money that is involved in negotiations. There's other things that can make your life better, too.
And Donna, very quickly, I'll ask the same of you, but is it any easier today than it was 5 years ago to make these cases?
Easier, no. And my best advice is, if you think you're being paid less, keep your thoughts to yourself, stay off of social media, don't complain about it electronically, gather your information, and then go see a lawyer.
All right. I want to thank you all so much for being with us. A very quick 35 minutes or so. Thank you, Donna Harper, for being with us. Lydia Padilla, thank you for being with us. And Sally Ebest, it's great to see you. Thanks for being with us. Coming up, former Senator Olympia Snow. She'll also address the issue of pay inequity and other things. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.